Welcome back. We are live with Attorney Don Advo from Mexican-occupied California, Southern California. Welcome to the show, Don.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming again. And, you know, on the last hour, I don't know if you heard it, but...
I did.
Reverend Mark Dankoff was talking about basically Hillary Clinton and her warmongering and how more and more people are catching on to this. It gave a lot of details, a lot of sources. And, you know, if Hillary Clinton, she's involved with a lot of stuff. And I'd like to talk to you about this new book that exposes a lot of sleazy stuff about Hillary Clinton. I'm going to say here right at the top of the show that if Donald Trump was the warmonger and Hillary was the one who was going to save us from a nuclear Armageddon, I wouldn't care if she was sleazy. I wouldn't care about any of the stuff we're talking about. But the fact is, she is so dangerous in so many ways, and really, she could kill us all. I mean, I know that sounds really alarmist, but I'm really alarmed. And if it takes something like this recent book by Dolly, what was her last name?
Dolly Kyle Browning.
Dolly Kyle Browning. If it takes something like this to wake people up, because the, you know, the military provocations that you know, the way we're provoking Russia and plunging, stumbling towards World War III. It's, I mean, the Russians talk about it. It's in the Russian press. Everybody in Russia is alarmed. Our controlled media doesn't talk about it. So it might take something like this book that regular people are going to hear about and understand. Maybe this is what we need. So would you like to detail some of the contents of the book, or should I detail some of them?
Well, you know, I'm happy to detail it. Basically, the book, it's by a woman named Dolly Kyle Browning, formerly Dolly Kyle of Arkansas. The title is Hillary, the Other Woman, a political memoir by Dolly Kyle. So I guess she's dropped the name Browning. She first appeared in the 1990s when a lot of the conservative media at the time, and this was before the internet was really very much more than in its infancy, and Dolly Kyle Browning came forward and talked about her experiences with Bill Clinton, and the gist of it was they knew each other in high school, and they were old friends and old lovers, and they had many affairs, and she says Bill was a sex addict, and so was she, and she, Dolly Kyle, realized it, and she got therapy and got help. And she knew Clinton in the early years when he was a young man in Arkansas. After he went away to college, he went away to, I think, Georgetown.
Georgetown, that's right.
Undergraduate. Then he went to Yale Law School, where he met Hillary Rodham. She'd gone to Wellesley College, undergraduate. And she's always been something of a mystery to me. Hillary Clinton, was ostensibly a Goldwater girl in the 1964 election. Apparently had a conservative upbringing in Illinois. Then she went away to Wellesley and came out a very, very disturbed, damaged person. You look at these pictures. The story I'm looking at, it's the Daily Mail website, and they have a review of this book and many of the it has a lot of old photographs of all of them, yearbook photographs of Bill Clinton and Dolly Kyle, and then pictures of Hillary Clinton when she was young and when she was at Yale Law School and when they first met. And Dolly Kyle is a strikingly beautiful woman, strikingly attractive, you know, statuesque and beautiful. And look at these pictures of Hillary. There's a physical dimension. There's a physical dimension to Hillary Clinton and her marriage to Bill. And there's something that is, I mean, apart from all the lying and the cheating and the backstabbing and all that, there's something very strange about the marriage between the Clintons. I mean, here you've got Bill, a hopeless womanizing horn dog, has had, by his own admission, many thousands of women, at least 2,000, one shudders to think what kind of STDs he's been exposed to over that long career. There's a woman in Arkansas, a black woman prostitute, who claims that Clinton fathered her male child, who is now, you know, in his 30s, and he has five children of his own. I forget his name. Roger Stone was talking about it, and he said, you know, this is Bill Clinton's son. There's really no doubt about it. In the 90s, there was a false story in the Daily Inquirer, then owned by a political ally of Bill Clinton, that a DNA test had proved Clinton was not the father. But Roger Stone says there was no DNA test, and Clinton is the father, and state troopers supposedly took Christmas presents to this black kid's house. And you look at a picture of the kid, and Danny Williams, that's his name, and he looks just like Clinton. He looks like a black Clinton. So for whatever that's worth, and you've got a man who cannot control his sexual impulses, and he's got a history of rapes and sexual assaults of women. I think the first woman we know of that he raped was a woman named Eileen Wellstone, a student at Oxford University. Clinton was there as a Rhodes Scholar, and he was expelled after Eileen Wellstone accused him of rape. Of course, the rape of Juanita Broderick has been well discussed, the sexual assaults on Paula Jones, and the woman, Kathleen Willey, has come out very prominently. I might add, all of these women are Democrats. Juanita Broderick was working at a Clinton attorney general campaign to get him reelected as attorney general of Arkansas. And when he raped her, he was, in fact, the attorney general of Arkansas. I mean, how scary is that, that this guy could be considered for high to be a high government official? And I recall throughout the 90s on conservative talk radio, there were all kinds of stories by people who knew Clinton, knew he was involved in the drug trade, and involved in all sorts of unsavory things. And I thought the best thing about the Clintons is that they would leave office and we would never hear from them again. They would slide into obscurity. How wrong I was. Of course, now Hillary is back. But the point I was getting at about the weirdness of the relationship is you look at pictures of them, Bill and Hillary, together, and then you look at a picture of Dolly Kyle, her yearbook picture. She's strikingly beautiful. Why does a man like Bill Clinton, with an insatiable appetite for beautiful women, end up married to something that looks like Hillary Clinton? I mean, she is one of the few women who has actually gotten less repulsive with old age. She's actually more attractive now than she was when she was in college.
Ugly duckling in college. I think she had better moments in her middle age. I'd agree with that.
I think so too. But the way she is described, you look at the pictures of her, and now it's come out that she's pretty much a lesbian. She's obvious. Uma Abedin and her are lovers. She has very little.
Uma Abedin, who is the wife of Anthony Weiner, the Weiner poster. Who was a congressman and ran for mayor of New York.
Yeah, there's an interesting angle to Anthony Weiner. He had an online relationship with some porn star in Chicago. I think her name was Leathers. She had her 15 minutes of fame. You know, she came out and talked about their relationship. She said the most extraordinary thing that this Leathers woman said about Weiner is that Weiner told her that his marriage was a complete sham, and the only time they were ever together was for photo ops, when either one of them was, well, of course, he was running for office, but the idea that the marriage was a complete sham. And, you know, I think that's true of the Clinton marriage.
And there's been a lot of allegations of that.
I don't think this is a marriage in the generally accepted sense of that term. I just think it is so weird that such an attractive, charismatic man ended up with a woman who is such a liability in so many ways, and who is so unspeakably evil.
The explanations in the book, I mean, Dolly explains that you know, Clinton was from a poor family, and basically he needed a sugar mama. He needed a financier, and that was Hillary. And for Hillary, what she needed, she was very ambitious, but not very charismatic, and she needed somebody's coattails. That's the word that Dolly used, coattails, right, to ride on. And that's certainly plausible, because that is what happened. Clinton is from not only is he from a poor family, but in the 70s and 80s, especially in the 70s, public jobs in Arkansas paid very, very little. I've checked the 1972 almanac, my old almanac, and the back in 72, that's a few years before Clinton was governor, but the governor of Arkansas made about $11,000 or $12,000 a year, which it was about the same as a public school teacher was elsewhere in the country. It was somewhat more. He might have been making, you know, $30,000 or $40,000 a year when he first became governor. You weren't going to amass much of a nest egg or political war chest as governor of Arkansas. And while they were married, Hillary was on the board of Walmart. She was a corporate lawyer. Hillary was the one who was making the money. And one of the things that was mentioned in the book is after, you know, Bill Clinton, I guess he was elected in 78 the first time, and then he lost, and he had to have a comeback. And during the period that he was out of office, I guess that's when Chelsea was born. And according to the book and according to other accounts, Hillary really didn't want anything to do with taking care of a baby. But according to Dolly's book, Bill did. He wanted to be a stay-at-home dad, at least for a while, which is something that Hillary objected to. But that's the way, you know, it's very plausible that Clinton needed a sugar mama and Hillary needed some coattails to ride on, because certainly that's how it's played out.
Well, I think you're probably right.
I don't know if I'm right, but it's plausible.
Well, I think you're probably right. I mean, that's the only plausible explanation you get. I've known marriages that were a people of affluent, well-to-do people, and you know they're open marriages, and people go their separate ways, and you know the man's got girlfriends, and the wife has lovers, and you know, as long as things are discreet and it isn't flaunted, life goes on, and people are happy with it. There's a lot of that goes on out here in California, a lot of it, more than you would think. But the point is that it was not just that she was unattractive; it was she was physically unhygienic. I mean, she had just physically grotesque and disgusting. So that's kind of an interesting angle to me. I think that there's something about people who lead deceptive double lives that makes them very, very vicious and very, very ugly and even sadistic. And I think that's part of Hillary's life. She's had to conceal so much her whole life. Concealment has become part of her life. And I think that there has to be a measure of resentment that goes on there, that you have constantly to present yourself as something other than what you really are. You have not only the stress of having to do that, of having to live a lie, but you have the stress, the concern, the fear of being exposed. And clearly the fear of exposure has haunted the Clintons throughout their entire joint career together. And I don't know how the public is going to, I think the whole lesbian thing is going to explode in her face this time around. I think Roger Stone is already talking about it, and he's got a pretty wide audience. So
very interesting.
Yeah,
there's been a lot of smoke. Have you heard Yoko Ono's allegations?
You know, I heard that, and boy, isn't that a
Yoko Ono claims to have had sex with Hillary Clinton back in the 1970s after having met at an anti-Vietnam War demonstration in Manhattan. She's made that claim public.
Yeah, that's pretty weird. I'm no particular fan of Yoko Ono, but I don't know why she would lie about it. I can't imagine.
She's not necessarily the most reliable source, but she's been stating it. Well, she has stated it publicly. There's been all these other allegations. You know, staffers have said that that what's Anthony Weiner's wife's name? Abedin.
Huma Abedin.
Huma Abedin. That Huma Abedin and Clinton, when they travel together, often share a room.
Yeah.
I'll have to find out from my State Department connections if they were doing that when she was Secretary of State. That would be very interesting.
Yeah, that was what Roger Stone said, and Roger Stone says the justification that was given for that was that Hillary had some medical condition and that she needed to have someone there, an attendant there, someone in the room with her, which seems kind of weird. I mean, you wonder what kind of condition, first of all, kind of condition does she have that would require that? And why would you want Huma Abedin? I mean, there's an ugliness and a grotesqueness about Hillary Clinton. And when she was first lady, she was reasonably attractive. Mm-hmm. But there's an ugliness about her. I don't know if you ever read the book Dangerous Liaisons. It was ultimately made into a movie.
No.
Well, it was made into a movie, and one of the characters is a Glenn Close character, and in the book, this is a manipulative woman who pits people against each other and destroys reputation.
Is this where Glenn Close puts a rabbit in the stew, a pet rabbit?
No. This is set in
I'm not a movie buff.
Pre-revolutionary France in the 1700s, and she's this social woman, and I mean, in the end. She does all these evil things, and her correspondence in those days, correspondence was all written. There were no telephones, no internet, and it was all written, and it was a great letters were very important because, they were sent, they were intercepted, and of course they could be stolen and, circulated around, and her correspondence was circulated around. At the end of the novel, people realized how completely evil she was, and somehow she transformed herself in the eyes of people who finally knew what she was, and they realized that she was a very ugly, ugly, vicious, cruel person, notwithstanding that before they knew the truth about her, she was very attractive. And that reminds me of the Clintons. And Huma Abedin, I mean, I look at this and I cannot imagine any man, being attracted to that. But even a woman, I mean, holy, she looks like a reptile. There's something so weird. I mean, the people of yesteryear, they at least had attractive lovers and attractive mistresses. And you look at today, it's this cult of weirdness, this cult of the ugly and the grotesque and the misshapen. It's like the third world transformation of our country, the racial transformation has really transformed it from a beautiful race and a beautiful country into a cult of ugliness. I mean, you can't imagine John F. Kennedy having somebody like Huma Abedin as a mistress or a lover, or Hillary Clinton.
I don't even know Huma Abedin would be considered in Pakistan or wherever she's native to. But in interviews or in newspaper or magazine accounts I've read, Huma Abedin describes the first time that she met Hillary. She was an intern at the White House when Hillary was first lady. And right. She describes Hillary as just being so beautiful. I mean, she uses very sexual terms. You know, she's so beautiful and small and delicate and all of this. So it makes it all very plausible.
Well, it does. We'll see.
But one thing is, homosexuality has been so mainstreamed now. So it'll be interesting to see how this might explode. Okay, we will be back after the break. We will be later on accepting some calls. The number is 1-800-313-9443. Back after. And tell him that his lonesome nights are over.
Elijah was a wooden Indian standing by the door. He fell in love with an Indian maid over in the antique store. Elijah.
And we are back.
Alternative media.
Patrick Slattery, and we're here with attorney Don Advo. And so we've been talking about how this this might blow up the whole what would you call it, camouflaged marriage slash lesbian aspect of this slash rape aspect, all these allegations that are coming out in the book. And so it may blow up. Then the other thing I wanted to just bring up was Donald Trump's, you know, the press making such a big deal out of this Trump University case where he said that he thinks he's being treated unfairly and that, you know, it could be that the judge is biased because the judge is Mexican and everybody's making such a big deal about it. Now, I want to ask you about whether or not the judge has been unfair. What because I, you know, I'm not a lawyer. I don't have much experience in court. I don't know whether the judge is being unfair or not. But I do know that whenever a plaintiff or a defendant who's black, for instance, feels that they're being treated unfairly, they'll say, "Oh, it's an all-white jury or a white judge," and there's no uproar about that. And we do see, this entire Jewish lobby that pursue their ethnic interests through, whether it's through court cases, whether it's through legislative process. So whether or not he's really being treated unfairly, if he perceives that he's being treated unfairly and is saying that there could be this ethnic angle to it, that's not at all unusual. But Don, I'd like to ask you, is he being treated unfairly?
Yes, I think he's being treated very unfairly, very unjustly. First of all, this Mexican judge should never have been confirmed. He is an admitted open racial advocate. He openly belongs to private organizations, the stated goal of which is the political and economic advancement of people based on the separate and distinct racial interests. He belongs to an organization called La Raza Lawyers Association or something like that. La Raza in Spanish means the race. He has shown racial favoritism. He is a racial partisan, a racial advocate. Apart from that, this Lawyers Association has advocated a boycott of all of Trump's economic endeavors, his businesses, and his various things. Now, this is a small
boycott
elitist.
Started after he started running, right? It's a response to his candidacy, right?
Yeah, well, I don't care when it started. If he is a member of an association and he hasn't resigned from the association, there should be a controversy about that. I mean, it's not like where you belong to some big omnipresent organization like the Democrat Party or the Republican Party. I mean, who knows what those, you know, anybody can believe in anything and still believe and belong to one of those parties. You know, I registered Republican, 50 years ago or however many years ago it was, probably wasn't that many years, but, you know, a long time ago, and I don't have any control over what anybody in that organization does. I got my one little vote. Well, this organization, this lawyer association, that's a very, very different thing. That's a private organization, not like the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, and he should withdraw from this case because he belongs to an exclusive small private organization that is actively trying to destroy both politically and economically a litigant who is appearing before him in a judicial proceeding. He ought to withdraw from the case, for Christ's sake. I mean, you know, if I were a judge and a member of my family came into court, I couldn't hear that. If someone who belonged to an organization that was engaged with one of the parties, or I just think he should withdraw. It's not only an appearance of impropriety, it is an act of impropriety for him to be involved in this case just by his mere membership in a small private organization, a very elite organization that is actively working against someone who appears before him. Mm-hmm. Now, he hasn't withdrawn from that organization. I mean, that might cure it at some level, but it's really disgusting. The thing the Sotomayor woman said about the wise Latina woman, the wise Latina crap. Let me tell you something. If there were a traffic case or a petty theft case, a shoplifting case, and a potential juror made a statement like that, they'd be thrown out of the courtroom for bias.
Okay, well, we'll be back after the break, and we will accept callers at 1-800-313.
Oh! Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood.
So, talking about the Trump University case and Judge Gonzalo, what was his name, Cuerta or something?
Curiel.
And how was it that he was assigned this case? How do the judges get assigned to cases?
Well, typically you go in and you file your case in the clerk's office, and the clerk is the one who assigns it to a judge, and it's assigned on a rotating basis. They have a little box of envelopes there, and you go and you file your case, pay your filing fee, and they stamp it. They put a case number on it, and then they pull out an envelope, and they open the envelope, and the envelope has the judge's name, and then it's signed to Judge Smith or Judge Jones, or in this case, Judge Curiel. Now, I don't know how the case got in San Diego. He's a New York resident. I don't know. I mean, that seems really weird to me that the case landed in San Diego, but maybe there's some other procedural maneuvers here of which I'm not familiar.
And it's filed by someone named Art Cohen.
Yeah, what a shock.
What a shock. Is Art Cohen from San Diego? Why is this? Do you know anything about that?
Nothing. I know nothing about the merits of the case or really anything about it. I wish Trump would have been a little more artful in explaining what the problem was. The problem was this man's racial favoritism, his racial advocacy, his membership in an explicitly racial group that is involved in this election by making a personal attack on Donald Trump and all of Donald Trump's businesses. And he shouldn't be a member of an organization that is waging economic and political warfare against someone who is a litigant in a case before him in court. It's like a judge, you know, who's the who owns the controlling interest in General Motors, and then he's you know, he's presiding over a case in which someone is sued by General Motors, or General Motors is suing someone. He ought to withdraw from the case.
And isn't the judge involved in some scholarship for illegal aliens?
Yeah, he's involved in an organization that gives scholarships to illegal aliens. It's more racial activism, more racial favoritism, more contempt and disregard for American law and sovereignty. Of course, this use of judicial power by judges for their ethnic advocacy and active ethnic partisanship is in the spirit of Jews. Yeah, throughout the early 20th century, when Jews got onto the bench, at just about every judicial level, there was a judge named John Mack, who was a strong Zionist, and he presided over the trial of the black nationalist Marcus Garvey. Mm-hmm. And Garvey was prosecuted, I don't know, for mail fraud or tax fraud or something. Some phony, you know, bullshit prosecution, and he was involved in trying to build up the black community economically. He had a very ambitious political and economic plan for the black community. I mean, one that anyone, frankly, could be very proud of.
You mean Marcus Garvey had the plan?
That was Marcus Garvey, and I'll tell you something else. I'm studying the history of immigration and opposition to immigration in its connection with free trade and protectionism, as those you know, most of our country's history, we had a protectionist philosophy. We had high tariffs that protected American jobs, that protected American workers. You know, wealthy business people can go anywhere, but workers are pretty much stuck where they are. Well, there were waves of immigration in the aftermath of the Civil War, and these were very harmful to black economic interests because they drove down wages for black people and drove black people out of jobs. And in the late 1800s, there was enormous rank and file black opposition to the floods of immigration. White immigration from Europe, by the way. White people coming in. And there was also a lot of popular opposition among just rank-and-file people. In 1897, there was a... Well, in 1885, there was the Contract Labor Act, which put limits on immigration coming in. And then in 1897, there was an immigration control law that was put in to put a cutback on immigration, swept through the House of Representatives, was passed by a small margin in the United States Senate. I mean, isn't that interesting that even more than 100 years ago, the United States Senate was much, much less... against immigration. In any event, Grover Cleveland, the only Democrat president in the last half of the since the Civil War,
since the
presidential election of 1860, he was a free trader, and he was also pro-immigration. And he vetoed that bill. Now, isn't it interesting? The party of the little guy is doing everything it can to flood this country with workers who will compete with the little guy and run down the little guy's wages. Yeah, and now you see today where black people are being hurt even more painfully in an economic and even in a physical sense. And one of the other things is how many race riots in the aftermath of the Civil War were caused by immigrants coming to this country and immigrant labor unions who were very, very violently opposed to black people. Well, today, you know, you had the takeover of the black civil rights movement in the early 1900s by the Jew created NAACP and Jew installed leadership. And thereafter, now that the black leadership is controlled by Jews, you see, the black leadership very, very strongly in support of immigration into this country that will hurt the economic and social prospects for black people. Wow. Isn't that an interesting historical transformation?
It sure is. Okay, we have callers. We have Dave in Ohio. Dave, are you there? Dave?
I prefer Donald Trump over Hillary, but I have to say, you know, right now we've got Trump under sort of scrutiny for this college that he ran, while we've got Hillary under scrutiny for these emails situation that she got herself into. And I mean, I think just on a gut level, you know, I don't support this Mexican judge, but I mean, I have to say this. University that Trump ran, it's very hard for me to feel sympathy toward him. It really just sounds like a, you know, you tell kids, come on to my university, and then you go out of business. You know, I mean, there are plenty of universities you can go to. They don't go out of business after you graduate. You know, and so I think when you compare that issue to the Hillary email issue, I think on a gut level, Trump looks a lot worse than Hillary does. I mean, you know, the average person, I mean, what is it that Hillary did? You know, you can talk about she did improper, all of this kind of stuff. But really, you know, when it comes down to just sort of sleazy, fraudulent business operations, I think Trump is the guy that really looks bad compared to Hillary on that one.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you heard what I was saying at the very top of the hour, I think there's really two existential issues, two issues that are really life and death for us. And one is what we were talking about last hour with Reverend Dankoff, how we're Hillary and really the Zionist elite are pushing us into this insane war with Russia, which could be World War III. It could end everything. And then the other existential issue is this flood of immigration. And it just so happens that on both issues, I mean, Hillary's the one who's pro-war. Hillary's the one who's pro-immigration. And Trump is the one who's on the right side of these two very, very important issues. And at the top of the hour, I said, if it was Hillary who was protecting us from a World War III, I wouldn't care about, you know, anything in her past, if she's a lesbian or if she's, you know, got sleazy business things. And the same way, I don't care about Trump University, or if he's, if Donald Trump's a sleazy, obnoxious businessman, but he's going to save us from World War III and save us from drowning, from literally being having our people replaced by Mexican immigrants. I don't care about the Trump University or any other little issue. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I would agree with you. I agree. That's my take also. But I'm just saying, though, that from a public relations point of view, he looks, I mean, him was trying to sell these stupid steaks that he was trying to sell. The man comes off as a very, very sleazy, underhanded, you know, just, you know, I'll sell you, you know, whatever I think I can make money. He comes off looking awfully bad, I think. You know?
Yeah, he probably has some work to do on public relations.
And I think that email scandal, I don't think really the average person, including myself, I mean, I don't really think, you know, big deal, she didn't, you know, follow protocols properly. I don't think people really care.
Yeah, the thing is that she wound up deleting a whole bunch of emails. And so, you know, in the State Department, there's supposed to be a paper trail. And, you know, she was engaged in a lot of things. It looks like she was using the email her office as Secretary of State to raise money for the Bill Clinton's foundation. Really at the bottom of that.
Yeah, I'm a Trump supporter. I can't stand Hillary, but I mean, I just think, though, on a gut level, Trump comes off looking awful stinky and smelly with this. All of these phony businesses that he's trying to make money on.
Yeah, and he has to be extra careful because the media is dead set against him. So, yeah, I agree. He could do a little bit better on the PR. Hey, Dave, thanks for your call. We have another call. We have Jeff in Idaho. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hey, guys. Hey, Russ, thanks for calling in with your political statements. Try and troll somewhere else. Hey, I had a couple comments for you. The reason why that Donald Trump did what he did about the case is that, as Russ should pay attention, Donald Trump's a little smarter. What Trump did is he basically set a tiger trap for these guys by basically making the true comment about the judge being racist about La Raza. But if you go to Don, you know Jonathan Turley, right, from Georgetown?
Well, yeah, I know who he is,
okay.
Yeah, okay.
Well, go check his website. On June 8th, he basically put out about the gigantic scandal about the Laureate Education lawsuit. It's tied in with the same thing with the Secretary of State thing that Russ was just trying to, like, poo-poo here a little while ago. I mean, it basically goes into, like, a gigantic scam, exactly like the, you know, Hillary Clinton right now is in violation of espionage right now by stripping the header off of this, by ordering this one guy to strip the header off of this classified information and send it by non-secure email. So, I mean, this is just the beginning of a lot of things. So you're going to have a lot of there's a $1 million troll army of people calling in like Russ earlier that are trying to basically say that, oh, Donald Trump. So Donald Trump basically knows what's going on, has a personal contact with Putin. He basically faxed Putin on February 12th, a couple days before Scalia died, about that these guys in the government are trying to basically probably eliminate him, and be careful because they're looking to start World War III against you. That's why the whole media is against Donald Trump, is that either the past 2 hours of your show are basically about that going on, is that Trump will stop World War III and Hillary will let it go. Right, but if you get a chance, yeah. Don, look at that. The title is called Clinton University Problem, Laureate Education Lawsuits. So the lawsuit against the Clintons is much bigger than the lawsuit against Trump.
Yeah, I've heard about it. I think the merits are very much different too. I think Bill sucked $16 million out of it, and the foundation got $55 million out of it or something.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that they basically attacked Trump to basically hide this thing, and now it's going to blow up in their face. Their PR is just not what it should be. You know what I'm saying? Mm. Yeah.
I hear you.
That's all I got, guys. Hey, thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. Okay, yeah. And we have Tony in Richmond. Tony, welcome to the show.
That's an artful speech, but when I heard Dave come on and say that Trump University problem is
I think Jeff was correct that Dave was a troll. I think it was correct. We've had somebody call in using different names all the time, but I think that was him.
Enemy action, and Trump's just running a local, you know, even if it is a hustle. And I don't think it is. I think the school was successful. It's just that some people, you know, filed claims they wanted to get their money back. And when they found out, oh, yeah, we can get our money back. But on the artful statement, and you made it, is Trump talks in very clipped language. I guess he's used to working to high-power people in his office, and he doesn't have to explain every single word. But it's killing him in the press. If, when he was presenting his side of the story with this judge, he had simply added the word "la raza," everybody would have known what the hell he was talking about. But instead, they used it as a leg up to call him a racist.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
That's my comment. He's done it a couple of times, so I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer offline.
Okay, well, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
So, I don't know. I mean, I think we've answered that, and I think Tony answered it himself in his question. Trump does have a little work to do on PR and a little bit of work to do on speaking different ways to different audiences. I think Tony made a good point that maybe he's used to speaking a certain way, to his inside people and doesn't need to explain every little detail. What do you think, Don?
Well, I think that's probably true. I think he does speak differently behind closed doors and when he's in a business meeting. I think all of us do. But, the problem with Curiel is not his Mexican heritage. You know, I was a young lawyer. We had a lot of Hispanic judges here in L.A. County, and most of them were very fine people. I mean, that was many years ago. But one thing I've noticed over the years, you know, many years ago when I was a young lawyer and you had these older gentlemen, Hispanic gentlemen, there was none of this racial in-your-face crap and hostility and racial warfare. They heard the case. They made the rulings. They were very, very judicial, very temperate, very professional. You know, there was none of this crap like, oh, I'm going to judge this case differently because I'm Hispanic, or we're going to get a different outcome in this case because of my life experience as a Hispanic. What is that crap about, you know? I mean, that's really destructive of our social, it's destructive of justice, of fair justice. Very, very few cases have anything to do with anybody's phony life experience. If a judge is going to decide a case on his life experience, he got to recuse himself. He is supposed to allow the case to be cited on the law, the evidence, the testimony of other people on the basis of other people's life experiences, not his. I hear the music.
That's the music. Okay, we have one more segment, so we'll be back after the break. Okay, and we're back for our last segment. We just have a few minutes. We do have one more caller, Fred in Idaho. Fred, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, Fred, welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Well, there were a couple things that I wanted to point out. Give me just a second here. Two very important things pertaining to what came up a little earlier. As a businessman, especially a successful businessman like Donald Trump, not every business is a success.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have your share of failures. That's just part of the process.
Right.
And as far as Trump University goes, I mean, I can't testify to the details, but as a person who recently graduated from college, the fact that he went out of business, I can't say this is why, but prices have gone through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the government is, I don't know exactly how it works, but I know the government is, you know, President Obama encouraged people to get, you know, go to college and get student loans. And I do know from my own experience, they ended about 18%. Okay, which.
And you can't declare bankruptcy on your student loans. You can't.
Well, if you can't pay it, yeah. But it's ridiculous.
I mean, you can declare bankruptcy, but you'll still owe your student loans. That's been a recent legal change.
I didn't know that. I haven't even looked into it.
That's right. Yeah, student loans are not dischargeable in bankruptcy unless you have some great physical disability. Okay. You know, you're blind and deaf and dumb or something. You had a stroke or you're in a wheelchair.
That was a recent change to the bankruptcy.
No, it's always been that way.
But there was something
it's ridiculous because, I mean, not only is it somewhat necessary, but, I mean, they encourage it like you would not believe. You know, it's like going to a, you know, used.
Yeah, it's a racket.
Place where they sell used cars.
Very high pressure thing.
Well, it's a form of getting people into, I guess, a kind of indentured servitude.
You're absolutely right.
It's awful. It's horribly crooked. And the thing is, you know, when I signed up, it was 1.5% or 1.75% interest. Low interest rate student loan. Okay, but as soon as you're done, it immediately goes up, and they don't notify you. And the first thing I heard was from a company that said, "Hey, we can lower your debt," and it was 12%. And they said we can bring it down to about 8%. I'm like, what? You know?
You didn't even know you were paying six months after I was out of school. Yeah.
Pardon?
Well, thanks for your call. We're just about out of time. Okay, so let's wrap things up here. This has been another fun show for me. I loved our guests in the first couple hours, and this was a great show. I want everybody to check out nationalbugle.com. It is a news aggregation website that's still in beta testing mode, but it's getting there. And ZioWatch, with a hyphen, ZioWatch.com. And that's news you can use about our Zionist friends. So we will be back. This is the Alternative Media with Patrick Slattery and Don Advo. I thought I heard the music. Yes, there is some music. That's the music. This is Gene Shepherd's old theme song. The Frau von Polka. So, until next week, keep your eye on the ball and never give up.